Good evening.
Lock
this is Talk
Radio.
My name is Dr. Baldwin McWilliams, and this is the Gist of Freedom. Today we have our guest is the great grandson of Ida B. Wells. Our guest is Mr. Dan Duster. Mr. Duster, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. We thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and share and just talk with us. If you could, just for our listeners, just tell us who you are and what you're currently doing.
Sure. Well, again, my name is Dan Duster. I'm one of the descendants of Ida B. Wells. I happen to be the great grandson. I guess I'll explain the lineage first, which is Ida had a total of, through marriage she had two other children, but through her own she had four children, the youngest of those four being Alfreda. Alfreda had five children, one of those being Donald, and Donald had three children, the youngest one being me, Daniel. So, That's the lineage. I've had my own company now for 12 years. I'm 43 years old. Went to University of Illinois, worked in corporate for a number of years, IBM, Abbott Diagnostics, Coca-Cola, and a few other places. And then I started my own company about 12 years ago doing motivational speaking and training.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm still doing. And one of the things that I do, in addition to professional development for corporate, is talk about Ida B. Wells to whoever will listen, corporate, schools, community churches, one of my passions for sure.
And is this one of the top or the main topic or the dominant topic of your motivational speakings, or do you touch on various areas, or is it specifically regarding Ms. Ida B. Wells?
I'd say it's the major part of my speaking. I'd say a good 50% of my speaking is relates to Ida B. Wells.
Okay. And if you can, for our listeners, just tell our listeners who Ida B. Wells was and why she is such an important figure to the American history or for American history.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first is that she's one of a number of people during our civil rights struggles, and our civil rights struggles have gone on for centuries. It was not just from 54 to 68.
Right.
So that's one. I say respectfully, Rosa Parks was the mother of the civil rights movement. And Fannie Lou Hamer was the grandmother. Ida B. Wells was the great-grandmother. Harriet Tubman was the great-great. And we go on and on.
Right.
But yeah, Ida B. Wells was very prominent in the late 1800s and early 1900s. She was actually born as a slave in 1862 in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And as a result, naturally, her parents were slaves, and they couldn't read. But the first thing that her parents did was make sure that she and her other siblings were able to go to school and learn how to read and write. And Ida was actually the oldest of eight children. One of them passed away at an early age. But her parents were very involved in the community, knew the value of education, and knew the value of being involved in the community and politically active, which they were. You know, when at the end of slavery, blacks technically had the same rights as whites, and her parents were definitely black folks that utilized those rights.
Great, great, great. And what was the issue that she was known for fighting, or what put her on the stage front and center?
Well, front and center was really her her anti-lynching crusade,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that started, you know, her development. I mentioned that she went to school to read and write, and actually went to the equivalent of almost college back in the late 1800s,
right.
And just different things in her life prepared her to be on center stage. At the
mm-hmm.
age of 16, both of her parents fell victim to yellow fever, and also one of her younger siblings. So it was Ida and her five younger siblings, and the family wanted to separate, and the extended family wanted to separate her family. And Ida
mm-hmm.
wouldn't have it. She was like, you know, no, I want my family to stay intact. So because she was educated, she was able to get a job as a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And would travel about 50 miles to be a teacher during the week and then come home with money and provide for family on the weekends. And naturally, it was the communities were different back then, where it was a community so that other people would help to watch out for the family. But Ida provided the financial support, so her family was able to maintain its status as a unit. And that really just thrust her into being very independent. You know, again, at 16 years old, being financially responsible for taking care of five kids. I'm 43, and that scares me right now. So that's one thing. The other, again, as she was a school teacher and then eventually became a school teacher in Memphis, and was in 1884 was forcibly removed from a rail car. Again, this was during the transition of blacks, of there being separate but equal laws for blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So physically fought with the conductor and two other men, was forcibly removed from the train. The clothes were torn, had bruises, and when she was ejected from the train, a lot of the passengers applauded. And that really helped set her up for being passionate about justice. And again, in addition to her parents' background for being advocates for justice and being involved in the community, Ida adapted that. But for that to happen to her, again, a very well-educated, very sophisticated woman to be forcibly removed by three men and have the crowd
right.
cheer just really lit a fire under her.
Right.
A few others happened along the way, and eventually she became a journalist. I mentioned she was a teacher in the Memphis school system. She was a freelance journalist as well, and she wrote an article speaking out against the Memphis school system. And as a result, she got fired. So that forced her into being a full-time journalist. She had to go find work on her own. She became a journalist. And that's what gave her the background to do that. In 1892, again, going back to the lynching, is that as now, when you hear something in the media, the tendency is to believe it. You may not believe all of it, but you believe part of it. And that's what
right.
she would expect. Oh, if some black men were lynched and there was an accusation of raping a white woman,
mm-hmm.
the inclination was to believe it. And she had three friends. She was so dear to one of them, she was actually godmother to his child, Thomas Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Will Stewart. And she was so close to Thomas, she was godmother to his child. They were store owners in Memphis. And the victim of you know, racism, jealousy, and you know, ethnic jealousy as well. So they had a successful store. You had a racist white store owner who didn't like that success and pretty much started a fight that escalated into two white men being shot by the black store owners. And pretty much all of the black men in town were rounded up and put in jail. After it was that the white men who were shot were going to be okay, the protection for the people in the jail left. And that evening, only the three store owners were pulled out, and they were taken to an area in Memphis that's called the Curve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, there's some tracks that go around it, but the area is barren. It's got some vegetation, but nothing is really there. There's, you know, nobody goes there, and it's still got an eerie feeling to it. I went there maybe 6 years ago, and it's still got a macabre feeling there.
Mm.
The men are beaten, tortured, and killed, and some of their parting words were, tell my people to go west, that there's no justice for them here. So Ida was out of town when that happened, and as a result, she did her own investigation and found out that a lot of the prominent people in town were involved in it, and that's what really opened her eyes to the barbarism of lynching, and how horrific it is and how unjust it is. So her passion was really a passion for justice. It so happened that the largest injustice in our country and probably in the world at that moment was lynching.
Right. And it sounds like, the whole lynching aspect, you know, so it sounds similar to stories that happened in Wall Street, such as Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and,
absolutely,
you know, things that have continued even up into the point of Emmett Till, just the story of lynching and its history and how much of it went unnoticed and well, not unnoticed in the black community, but really not dealt with. And there were several attempts by the mainstream establishment to just look over these things. And I think it says something, and it speaks to Ida B. Wells' love of justice and sense of justice to really go out and investigate these lynching crimes, because I imagine it wasn't an easy thing to do.
No, not at all. I mean, her vision and her ambition and courage are absolutely amazing and make me feel cowardly for when I'm complaining about the problems that I face today, because what she faced was absolutely daunting, and she was able to get through it. You know, going back to the lynching, is that lynching, Dr. McWilliams, was really a form of domestic terrorism. It was intentionally designed to keep black people in fear, because after slavery, we were not owned. But in order for, and again, racist white people, I want to make sure I make that distinction, because were it not for the white people who were in support of black people, you know, we'd still be in a bad way in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So when I speak of the racist white people, I want to make sure that it is restricted to them. But,
right,
you know, if they wanted to have power and they couldn't legally do anything, then they used this domestic terrorism to do that. And lynching was, again, it's associated with hanging, but it's far more barbaric than that. It's torture. It's a public display of that barbarism so that people are living in fear.
Now, I'm not sure if you mentioned it early, Mr. Duster, but I was wondering, was Ida B. Wells, did she grow up in an all-black community, and was that community also a free black community?
So she grew up as a slave and grew up after slavery, they did pretty much the sharecropping.
Okay,
so
right.
It was not an all-black community, but again, after 1865, it was a free black community.
Okay. And I was trying to get a sense of where her fervor for justice and her love of justice came from, and I know you spoke to her experience on the train as well, the fact that people were cheering that she was being thrown off the train. I'm sure that was, as you said, lit a fire under her and a sense of motivation to kind of correct such an injustice like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
what happened as a result of that, she actually sued the railroad and won.
Mm.
And
she
was masterful at making the problem bigger than herself.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, so in addition to fighting the conductor one-on-one, or eventually one-on-three, instead of just taking it and saying, I'm going to get the conductor, she was like, no, I want to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody in my community or anybody in the U.S., and sued the railroad and won. And she did that with lynching. It was not just about lynching in Memphis. She orchestrated a boycott after her friends were lynched. She orchestrated a boycott of the trolley cars in Memphis and was effective for several months. And until she got them to agree to treat blacks with more respect, they kept the boycott going. She was responsible. Again, some of the words were, tell my people to go west. There's no justice for them here. She orchestrated a large migration from Memphis to the west, to Arkansas, and went investigated, you know, to make sure Arkansas was safe and a better climate for black people, and was responsible for upwards of 6,000 black people physically moving from Memphis west. And that probably represented 25% of the black population. So where she got it from is, I don't know. But, you know, for her to orchestrate boycotts to say, you know, that move, pick up and move. And moving back then in the late 1890s or 1892 was not easy. She also took, they would send, for lynchings, you can picture somebody standing next to a large Florida marlin or bear that they've killed.
Right.
People do that with lynchings. They take a picture saying, hey, look what I did, look what we did. Which
sure,
I can do
right.
It. They send it via postcards. So I had collected pictures and went to Europe. She went to England and Scotland to talk about the tragedies that were happening in the U.S. and to embarrass the U.S. Because, again, the U.S. is founded on life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, freedom, and justice for all. And would she take started to say that the Negro is not getting justice here, and orchestrated boycotts from England and Scotland for cotton. Again, U.S. was the largest exporter of cotton at the time.
And they
were the largest importers. So it really did a effective job of both shaming the U.S. and making it economic as well. And, you know, that's true throughout history. Once things become economic, then change is made.
Right. And what it did, what she also did, as we talked earlier about this, the concept of the civil rights movement, she also internationalized and broadened the movement and made it bigger than just a civil or United States issue, but made it more of an international human rights issue. And I know for me, I wonder how big a threat that might have been. I guess, I mean, how threatening was that in the sense that, you know, when Malcolm X, for instance, expanded it and tried to meet with people internationally, when, you know, Paul Ropes, and when these people went international, it almost seemed like they were shunned by the United States government and made things that much more harder for them. So I guess I'm asking you, how much harder did things get for Ida B. Wells after she made the attempt to internationalize some of the atrocities that were going on here in America?
Well, you know what? I can't say that it became more difficult because it was already extremely difficult. And it was difficult for her on a few fronts. One, you know, being a black woman in that time frame, you're at a double negative, in that females are considered second-class citizens by all means, and blacks are considered second-class citizens. So she didn't get as much support as she would have liked and from anybody. And because she was so outspoken and so stubborn and obstinate, it was tough for her to garner a whole bunch of support from one base. And the couple of examples are, she was, you know, friends, contemporaries with Frederick Douglass. And Frederick, it was kind of like the Malcolm Martin deal, where Frederick was more passive. He's like, you know, if I deserve a loaf of bread, you've got a loaf of bread. If you give me a half, that's progress. I feel like, if I deserve a loaf of bread, you got the loaf of bread, give me the whole loaf, not a crumb.
Right.
And with that philosophy, she headbutted with a lot of folks because she was uncompromising. And with any civil rights movement, you need both.
Right.
So the other challenge that she had was with the women's suffrage movement. When she was in England, she learned a lot about suffrage movements and about organizing, and she brought that knowledge back to the U.S. And back when she moved to Chicago in 1894. And started a lot of clubs and organizations, and would clash with the women's suffrage movement because she wanted to be married. And the notion at that time was, again, especially the role of marriage was considered to be subservient.
Right.
That
okay.
Time. So it's like, how are you going to be an advocate for the women's suffrage movement when you're taking a subservient role in front of everybody? And Ida was like, I can do both, trust me.
right. Yeah, I think that speaks to just her ability to even be self-defining and be able to define things for herself and not necessarily fall into a particular stereotype or be put into a particular box. And I think that was one of the things in my readings and learning about Ida B. Wells and her being so outspoken. Those are some of the things I took away from her character, the sense that she didn't necessarily want to be boxed in into any category. She was able to define and, you know, define things for herself and be self-defining. And with that point in mind, I also want to know, what were her views on Du Bois and Garvey and Booker T? I remember reading that she was part of the Niagara Movement, and when Du Bois and others moved from the Niagara Movement into the NAACP, there were some issues as far as having Ida B. Wells join, you know, amongst that movement into the NAACP, and that I think I remember reading that even W.B. Du Bois might have even been against her joining that. Have you heard anything close to that?
Yes. I have heard that. And she was, again, being obstinate and demanding. She did not make that transition fully into the NAACP because she felt that they were not adamant enough about one of the core, her core thing was, let's make lynching a federal crime. Let's about some legislation to do that. And the notion, again, is pretty much like half a loaf of bread. Well, we don't have it right now, but let's galvanize around one issue. Let's not do lynching right now. And she's like, lynching needs to be at the forefront, otherwise I'm not doing this. So that's my understanding of her biggest reason that she said, I'm not joining this group if you all don't have the courage to say lynching needs to be top priority. And she began, again, an advocate for lynching for years, because that was in 1909.
Right.
And her first exposure to it, where it made it personal, was in 1892, so it's been 17 years. And twice she met with President McKinley. I know in 1898 she met with President McKinley to make lynching a federal crime. And the significance behind that, because you think, okay, well, it's murder. What's the difference if somebody's supposed to be tried? Is that Dr. McWilliams, in literally 98%+ of lynchings, nobody was found guilty.
Right.
And this
right.
Close to 5,000 lynchings during this time period. So during that time period, so, again, and the role of federal making it a federal crime is that it would have brought federal resources to do the investigations. So if it's a local crime, and I know the sheriff's brother, then nobody's going to be found guilty, and that's what happened more often than not.
Right. Good point. And were those basically the differences that she had? I mean, was that if you could tell our listeners, if you can, the difference between the Niagara Movement and the NAACP? I know you touched on it briefly, but was her transition or her refusal to transition into the NAACP because of their refusal to address the lynching aspect?
Right. That is my understanding, is that she had the Niagara Movement, which was the committee of, I want to say the Committee of 40, and the discussion there was let's make a formal organization. And that formal organization was the NAACP. And so my understanding is that the founding members or the people who were at the committee were the founding members of the NAACP. Now, whether she actually was the founding member and then resigned, or she decided, I'm not moving forward from the Niagara Movement, I'm not clear about that.
Okay. Good. And I think, you know, again, I think that she is such an important figure in American history, but I still believe that she's not mentioned as much and as often as she should be. I'm wondering, how old were you when you first discovered that you had a relation to Ida B. Wells, and what effect did it have on you?
Well, let's see, pretty much as long as I can remember, and if I were to tell a story, I would say lower your expectations about the impact that it had on me. my family was intentionally, my father in particular was intentionally, I guess I would say, calm about it, maybe a good word, and that he didn't want us to have, I guess, neither the burden nor any arrogance around being related to Ida B. Wells. So what I did find out later on in life, so I through my teachers, you know, they'd say, oh, you're Duster, you're, you know, Donald's son, and, you know, you're descendant of Ida B. Wells. So I had knowledge of it, but, again, I didn't start advocating on behalf of Ida B. Wells or for the black community until later in life, until after college. And some of the values that were that were passed down, and this is through conversations, I found out through conversations shortly after college, were her values. One is integrity, in that she's not going to do anything that she didn't feel was right at her core. And again, that's what makes her uncompromising. You know, integrity is a tough thing to have all the time, and it was her intent to have it. The family values, again, the intent was for the mother to stay at home as much as possible during the formative years with the children. And she did that, but she also, she married Ferdinand Barnett, so I'll go back to him in a moment. So the family values were important. Education was crucial for Ida. She, again, having her parents having the value for education. And again, that's the thing with slavery is that, you know, when you didn't have it, as soon as you could get it, you had full value for it. So that was passed down to her, and she passed it on to her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. All of her five grandchildren have advanced degrees, or five of her grandchildren, this is my father's siblings, and all of the great-grandchildren went to college. So those values were obviously passed down, and again, we didn't know it until later on. That was passed down.
Now, did you, in your story, you were telling us that your dad made a conscious effort to kind of, I guess, be calm about sharing your relation to Ida B. Wells. Did you agree with that tactic, or was there a way in, you know, maybe you felt like there should have been more excitement around that? And how does he feel about the work you're doing right now?
Let's see. I guess it depends on from what perspective you're saying. As a youth, I was absolutely fine with it. As an adult, I understand and I agree with it. I think that there's value in having your own identity versus, especially as a youth, growing up and saying I'm the great grandson of Ida B. Wells. Right now, that's a conscious choice that I make because I want to educate people about her and about other people in African American history. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy that I guess I didn't feel a burden or my identity was not related to Ida B. Wells so much as a youth. And what's interesting is that through high school, I was very popular and ended up being class president, most popular, most likely to succeed, and so forth. And, you know, it wasn't until after college that I started speaking publicly and giving keynote speeches about Ida B. Wells. And I had so many classmates that were disappointed that, you know, I didn't tell them. And it was just, you know, it was like, well, I'm me, and I happen to be the descendant of Ida B. Wells. I had nothing to do with it. I'm proud, but you know that's I had nothing to do with what she did. I'm definitely proud, and you know I'd like to advocate for her as much as possible. And going back to, you know, she doesn't get as much recognition. Just women in general, and African American women in particular, don't get the recognition that they deserve as far as contributing to our country's success and advocating for civil rights.
Right. And so when you got to that point when you felt that you needed or you wanted to begin to speak, you know, what was it that brought you to that point where you said, you know what, this is something I do want to talk about, this is a legacy that I want to make known to the community, and what has been the community sentiments in regards to, you know, your actions as far as speaking and spreading the legacy of Ida B. Wells?
Oh, it's well received. The part of, you know, I think things happen in your past that or in your life to say, you know what, I need to do a better job of educating people about civil rights and about Ida B. Wells. So just, and again, I would say naive versus ignorant. Naive people, you know, thinking that you know, one of my biggest irritants is us saying that there was a civil rights movement and saying that's from 54 to 68.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been fighting long before and are still fighting for civil and equal rights.
Right.
So I think
right.
It's important for us to know that. As far as Ida B. Wells, she had a housing development here named after her, so there was pretty good name recognition in Chicago for the name Ida B. Wells. A lot of folks, especially, you know, at the school age, were not familiar with her. And that's where it became like, okay, well, let me take advantage of it, especially in Chicago, since she had name recognition. You can tie in the legacy of Ida B. Wells and with a name. So that name is very prominent in Chicago, although people weren't familiar with her story. So to be able to educate people about her story, especially in Chicago, was fulfilling. Nationally, when people know her, they love her. And especially people that are either historians or in journalism, because she is definitely highlighted as far as journalism goes. So that's some of the reasons that I decided to do it. And again, it makes for a nice way for me to make an impact, is to utilize that legacy so that I can, you know, tell people about some of the key things in life. And I've got two keynotes that I do as it relates to her. One of them is Stand Up for Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And it evolved from, I've been talking about Ida B. Wells off and on for 20 years. But I finally met a guy, because I always wondered with lynchings, sometimes it was spontaneous where you'd have a group and go out and do it. Oftentimes it was planned and it was an event. And literally, there are hundreds or even thousands of people watch it.
Right.
And I'd always wondered what would have happened if, especially if it was spontaneous, if people had said, you know what, stop. You know, we've beaten the guy up. We don't need to kill him. Or, you know, during some of the torches, like, okay, we've done enough. This is actually a person. This is a man. This is a human being. We shouldn't be doing this.
It just makes me think, I just wanted to get this point in, it makes me wonder, did your family ever talk about perhaps the risk or how much their lives might have been in jeopardy as a result of the work of Ida B. Wells? Because if I'm correct, I believe when she wrote her anti-lynching papers, she had to use an anonymous name, correct?
Well, so she had the pen name of Iola.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. So it wasn't Iola Wells. It was just Iola, which looks like Ida when it's written out.
Mm-hmm.
So she did some of that under her pen name of Iola. But when she published some of those findings, she published some things in the paper talking about lynchings and the number of lynchings that happened and accusations, the false accusations. And did some investigations, especially where black men were accused of raping white women, and talked to the women. And oftentimes there was no sex at all. And then sometimes if there were sex, it was consensual. And she published this.
Uh-huh.
And she owned a paper in Memphis, the Free Speech. And it's debated whether she was intentionally out of town or it was a miracle. When people came out, her printing press was destroyed, and they said if she would ever return, she'd be lynched too.
Wow.
She didn't return from the South from 1893 until around 1920, so it was almost 30 years.
And the name of that paper again was called Free Speech?
Yeah, the Memphis Free Speech.
Memphis Free Speech. Do you still have do you have any copies or anything pertaining to her paper?
I don't, and I don't know what he did. What my father's, Ida's daughter, Alfreda, had kept some things of Ida. And Alfreda and then her children decided that rather than trying to divide it up amongst the family or, you know, keep it in a drawer, to allow the University of Chicago, Regenstein Library, to have it. So that people, you can have public access. Because it's like, okay, if it's on my mantle, people can't see it, but if it's at the, you know, at a public library, the public will have access to it. So.
And that's at the University of Chicago, correct?
Yeah, University of Chicago, Regenstein Library is where.
Regenstein Library.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one of the things, in listening to her story, I'm trying to figure out what made Miss Ida B. Wells move to Mississippi. Because Mississippi, you know, it has a reputation of being one of the most vicious and one of the most racist states in the United States, and it is known for a lot of its unsolved crimes and unsolved murders of black men, particularly through the technique of lynching.
Mm-hmm. Well, so she was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi, in Holly Springs, Mississippi.
Okay. Okay.
So, because she was born there, that's where she initially got work. She moved to Memphis because that's where better work was, and she was able to get a job as a school teacher, and then eventually on. A newspaper, and again, with mm-hmm. her own papers, that was her being very ambitious, courageous, and obstinate. So she got a newspaper there. I mentioned, so that is why she moved to Memphis. Again, she had to move from Memphis because it was not safe for her.
Right,
it's,
right.
Legend has it that she carried at least one, if not two, pistols on her because she knew that people were going after her life. And her
right.
thought was, rather than go down like a rat running away, if they come after me, I'm going to take at least one with me.
Right, right. So how did she end up in Chicago?
Ended up in Chicago. She visited Chicago in 1893 for the World's Fair, which was called the Columbian Exposition. Mm-hmm. And that's where she met Ferdinand Barnett, who was an activist and a lawyer. And mm-hmm. Ferdinand had been married before to an African-American woman who passed away. So he had two children from that marriage. And Ferdinand, he was a cool brother. He wanted to fire everyone. So again, after his first wife passed away, you know, a lot of women were interested. He's like, no, I want somebody with fire. And he met Ida immediately. You're
right.
One. So he owned a paper in Chicago as well. And it was called Servitor, and Ida negotiated as part of the marriage that she take ownership of the paper.
All right. So, that was part of the marriage, so that wasn't a situation where he had to pass away first, huh?
Right, right. He's like, if you want to marry me, give me your paper.
Well, that says something about Miss Wells at the same time. Now, are you from Chicago as well?
Born and raised, yes.
Okay, and is this where you do majority of your speaking, or have you traveled across the nation? Have you traveled internationally yet?
I have not traveled internationally speaking about Ida.
Mm-hmm.
I have traveled internationally, but no, I've just traveled throughout the U.S. and more so throughout the Midwest.
Okay.
I've spoken about her in D.C., Houston, Michigan, Tennessee, Florida.
And have you recognized or have you sensed a growing interest in Ida B. Wells?
You know what, there is. There uh-huh. is. When I first started out, the interest was moderate, and there seems to be a big push about that period of black history and about Ida B. Wells in particular, which I think is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Great, great, great. Now, not my last question, but one of the questions I wanted to ask is what makes, and I'm sure you ask this question all the time, what makes Ida B. Wells relevant in 2012? Why is her story still necessary? Why is it still important that people understand who she is and the work that she contributed to?
Oh, let's see, for several reasons. One, going back to the keynote that I started to talk about, which is Stand Up for Justice, is she was a crusader for justice, and happens that the biggest injustice in America was lynching. So that's why she chose to speak out against it. But she spoke out against whatever was there. Again, she was very prominent in the women's suffrage movement as well. She was instrumental in the black migration because she had such a following. She would write in her papers, which were distributed throughout the South. She wrote from Chicago, but they'd be distributed throughout the South. Please come up north. I mean, conditions aren't perfect here, but it's a lot better than what you're experiencing in the South. And not only did she do that, she worked with churches and other community organizations to have transitional housing, so when people moved up from the South, they could get themselves settled, find work, and then move out on their own. So
right. That's
just, again, she was all about justice. And when I say stand up for justice, going back to lynchings, what would happen if one person stood up while at a lynching? I met James Cameron, was namesake to the movie director, and he's America's oldest known lynching victim. He passed away, I believe, in 2007. But he was all but lynched, and one person in the crowd spoke loudly and strongly enough and said, stop, and hollered, stop.
Wow.
You know, cut the man down, and they cut him down, and this was in 1930. He lived for another 77 years and started the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And
I know
if I had been part of that crowd, she would have been one to say stop. And while we don't see injustice, while we don't necessarily see lynchings any longer, technical lynchings, we still see injustices. And injustices all around us, whether it's in a school and you see somebody being bullied, or you see somebody disrespecting a teacher or another classmate, and you don't say anything. That's what I call being a guilty bystander. Back when I was talking about the large crowds, if you've got, you know, the home team has home field advantage because of the crowd, because of that energy. So if you're at an event, at a function, and you don't say anything, you're condoning it. And I say that you're not an innocent bystander, but a guilty bystander. And
right.
What's going to happen in front of Ida B. Wells? So whether it's somebody, kids in your community, smoking or drinking when they should be in school, whether it's a corporation, you know, cooking the books or laughing at a sexist or racist joke and you laugh at it or you don't say anything, you're condoning it. And you get somebody as courageous as Ida B. Wells, Ida B. Wells is going to speak out against any injustice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so just knowing that, and again, I say injustice is like a roach. If you see it and don't squash it, you can't be mad when more comes later on.
Right. And then with that in mind, I was going to ask you, what do you think would be the issue that Ida B. Wells would address in today's time? Whether it be, you know, youth violence, the gun violence, you know, the prison industrial complex. Which one of these issues you think that Ida B. Wells would pay particular attention to?
Wow, great question. I'd say the couple that jumps to mind, again, youth violence is definitely one. And again, that's, I think the difficulty as it is right now, how do you mitigate that? What do you address to make sure it doesn't happen? And part of that is, you know, having equal rights and equal opportunities for jobs. And while we're a lot closer than we were during her time frame, it's still not equal rights, equal opportunities. And again, she spoke out against the educational system, and I think that would be her biggest thing to say. It's still in our educational system. The structure of it is absolutely an injustice. And so I know she'd speak out against that. She'd probably speak out against the profiling and some of the discrimination that happens for people of color, especially, you know, as it relates to immigrants and or suspected immigrants. I would imagine that she may have something to say about that as well.
So, and you mentioned earlier that she carried a pistol with her. I wonder what role that pistol might play in how she in her interaction with, gangs and crime that we're dealing with on the streets here. I mean, would it be a situation you believe where she would be as confrontational to the gangs on the street as she would, let's say, the KKK?
Absolutely. And again, what I say to black women and I mean this is holding you up higher than I think a lot of black women hold themselves, is that black men should be the cornerstone of our communities. Black women really are. If they hold themselves and our men to a higher standard, then we'll do it. I think black women have the ability to confront black men and say, no, you shouldn't be doing this. You should not be on this corner. And they may act disrespectful for the moment, but bottom line, they're going to show more respect to that woman and to that community longer term. And I think that's the opportunity, our biggest opportunity for change in our attempt to reclaim our communities is the black woman holding the community and black men to a higher standard.
And what do you think her position would be on maybe perhaps some of it? And I'm just trying to figure, you know, in making her relevant today, what do you think her critique would be on, let's say, some of the rap music that we hear, the music that we hear on, commercial radio?
Oh, I think she'd have a big issue with it. Mm-hmm. You know, what's unfortunate is, so speaking from my perspective, which I think Ida would agree with, is, you know, rap has its place. I think that what's been done with rap music and the stereotyping of the black male in particular as a result of it is what's gone awry. Is that the music itself, again, it's not the beat, it's the words and the portrayal of black males as the thug life and the violent life. And we really absorb that in our psyche and believe that that's how we should act. And so she would definitely speak out against the behaviors that are associated with rap music.
Well, Mr. Dunn and Duster, I thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about your great-grandmother, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Your great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells. We thank you very much. And if you can, just tell our listeners how they can get in contact with you if they want to get in contact with you.
Sure. So once again, thank you for inviting me on the show. It was absolutely an honor, and I appreciate you and what you do. Week in, week out, you are advocating for black people and enlightening our listeners and our country about black history. So I want to take time to say thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Certainly, certainly. The easiest thing to do is go to my website, danduster.net. So it's danduster.net, not .com.
Okay.
And shoot me an email. Dan@danduster.net, or feel free to my personal phone number is area code 773-859-1064. Again, 773-859-1064. I'm happy to come speak to you or give advice, whatever I can do to help out and advocate. I'm absolutely willing to do that.
And do you have any events or any books, anything coming up in the near future?
I don't. February,
okay.
And, you know, just my frustration with society is, you know, February is where I'm by far the most busiest.
Right.
I'll probably be in the harbor because now this is Women's History Month. So I still do a couple of things there. And I've got two things in the work, but nothing is finalized. But now February is definitely the more popular month.
Well, I know I'm an instructor. I'm a faculty member at Cheney University, and I'm definitely going to work to see if we can get you down there to tell the story of Miss Ida B. Wells.
Oh, well, let's make it happen. You let me know, and I'll be there.
All right. I thank you again for taking time out to share your story with us and to share the story of your great-grandmother, a staple in not just African-American history but in American history, Miss Ida B. Wells. Again, Mr. Dan Duster, thank you for your time. And for our listeners, we thank you for listening. And until next week, God bless.
Dr. McWilliams, take care. Thank you again.
Thank you.